Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Another 180 for President Trump. First, he walked back plans to kill Obamacare. Then he reversed an earlier call to close the U.S.-Mexico border.
If the drugs don't stop, Mexico can stop them if they want. We're going to tariff the cars. The cars are very big. And if that doesn't work, we're going to close the border.
Too close for comfort, women step forward to say former Vice President Joe Biden made them feel uncomfortable. Biden did not apologize, but released a video.
I hear what they're saying. I understand it. And I'll be much more mindful. That's my responsibility. My responsibility, and I'll meet it.
A White House whistleblower says security clearances were issued that should not have been. She spoke with NBC.
The protection of national security is not a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. It's an American issue.
Join us. What's moving the world this week? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook, where they're at On Point Radio. With me in the studio this hour, Kimberly Atkins, WBUR's senior Washington correspondent. Kim, great to have you here.
Great to be here.
With us from Washington is Fernando Pizarro. He covers Congress, the White House, and the federal government for Univision. Fernando, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Kim, and Fernando.
So let's start with the House Judiciary Committee this week authorizing a subpoena to force the Justice Department to give Congress a full copy of the special counsel Robert Mueller's report. Kimberly, let's start with you. It's been 2 weeks since Robert Mueller released his findings. Your reaction to this House subpoena?
I mean, I think that's what was expected. We knew that lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers in the House, particularly those in the committees that are investigating various aspects of President Trump, were going to want this information. They want the full Mueller report. They have the ability to see even the classified parts of it. They want the underlying evidence so that they can see how these conclusions were drawn. And I think the reports that even Mueller's investigators were unhappy with William Barr's Attorney General Barr's classification of it only adds fuel to the fire that Democrats have.
Fernando, I'm surprised it took 2 weeks for the Democrats to step up here and say, give us their report.
Yes, it's taken them a long time to get this done, as they promised to act as soon as they would have the report. Let's remember that it also includes subpoenas for evidence from some of the president's closest advisors or former advisors like Steve Bannon, Hope Hicks, Reince Priebus, and a whole bunch of others. But as Kimberly was saying, the whole idea as well that some of the investigators of the report are telling some of their colleagues or let it be known that they are not very happy with the summary that Attorney General Barr gave on March 24th to Congress because they feel it doesn't adequately portray the findings of their investigation, mm-hmm. that they could be more problematic for President Trump, that it's been meant to or was said or implied in the report that Barr sent to Congress that's also making a lot of news this week.
Here is House Judiciary Chairman Gerald Nadler saying that it's important that the full report by Special Counsel Robert Mueller be released. Here he is at a Capitol Hill hearing on Wednesday.
The Constitution charges Congress with holding the president accountable for alleged official misconduct. That job requires us to evaluate the evidence for ourselves. Not the Attorney General's summary, not a substantially redacted synopsis, but the full report and the underlying evidence.
And here's President Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, on Wednesday night on Fox News, responding to the Democrats' request to release the Mueller report in its entirety. Here's what he said.
There are a bunch of sneaky, unethical leakers, and they are rabid Democrats who hate the President of the United States. I am absolutely confident that the report will bear out the conclusions. The conclusions, no obstruction, no Russian collusion of any kind. It will bear that out.
So there's Rudy Giuliani, Kimberly Atkins, saying the report will bear out the conclusions that we heard from Bill Barr. But as Fernando said, some of Robert Mueller's investigators have told Associates that Bill Barr didn't accurately portray the findings of their inquiry and that it was more troubling for President Trump than Barr indicated.
Yes, according to reporting by The Washington Post and The New York Times, these investigators said they built into the report summaries that could be easily released to the public for the very purpose of having more disclosure and really giving a clear picture as to what they found, and that William Barr took just a couple of sentences out of that, not even full sentences, and put it in this four-page letter, which was the only thing that came out. And that is why we are here with demands to see it, everybody classifying it in a different way. Initially, President Trump said, you know, it's up to the Attorney General, let it be released. And now he's sort of pulling back, and you're hearing him and other Republicans saying, you know what, it's just the Democrats trying to make something out of nothing, and even if you gave them 10,000 pages, that wouldn't be enough.
Fernando, these members of Mueller's team are also reportedly saying that they are concerned that that Bill Barr has created this first narrative of the report and that Americans will have some sort of conclusion or perhaps a hardened view of it before the actual conclusions become public.
Well, they've said as well that they actually had, as Kimberly was mentioning, they had actually done their own summaries as this investigation went along. So they're very concerned that they feel that, as you say, the narrative that Attorney General Barr has presented to Congress, of which, of course, we've seen very little of it and the rest of the nation, it's not exactly what was included in those summaries that the investigators themselves had been compiling over the last few months. So obviously they are concerned that they want that to be included in any kind of summary that the Attorney General would have released to Congress. And so now, again, I guess they're going to be pushing for a full release of the report as well.
Jack Beatty, how did you see all this?
Well, I was struck with William Barr. Here's a man with, what's the phrase, sterling reputation, who seems to have placed it at risk. You know, in his testimony before Congress, Michael Cohen said that if you work for Trump, the first thing you do when you get up in the morning is you figure out how to further Mr. Trump's plans, which often rests on deceit. Deceitful himself, the president appears to be the cause of deceit in others. Witness Barr, who now has, according to these people, the retorts from the Mueller people, spun, deceived, call it what you will, this initial report to Congress in a way that will soon be exposed. And it's the kind of thing that seems to happen again and again to people who work for Mr. Trump. Their reputations are at risk.
Let me get a caller in on this point. David in York, Maine. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hey, well, thank you.
I heard Devin Nunes this morning on Fox News impugning the integrity of the Mueller report. He actually called it the Mueller dossier. Now, this is the Mueller report that Attorney General Barr summarized as saying it completely exonerated Trump. So you've got Devin Nunes, the president's point man in Congress, impugning the integrity of the report that supposedly it completely exonerated him. I'm just hoping maybe your panel can explain that.
David, thank you. Kimberly Atkins?
I mean, it may be trying to defensively or preemptively guard against any information in this report that will come out that is negative to the president. We know that Congressman Nunes is one of the president's biggest defenders. We also know that, according to Attorney General Barr himself, his letter, that some of the evidence that is contained in this report is evidence that could support obstruction. We know that Robert Mueller didn't make a determination. He said that there is evidence on both sides of it, and he left it up to someone else, perhaps Congress, to make the final call. So maybe they're worried about that obstruction evidence.
Well, House Democrats certainly flexing their muscles right now with the subpoena for the Mueller report. And this week also the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee formally requesting that the IRS hand over 6 years of President Trump's personal and business tax returns. Fernando, this sets up a momentous fight with the administration. The president saying during the campaign way back that he would not release his tax returns. He's under audit. Give me your sense of this week.
Well, the president this week as well said at the Oval Office that he, responding to reporters, that he thinks that they're going to have to talk to his lawyers or to Attorney General Barr again. The White House is still claiming that the president's tax returns are under audit, which was the big excuse he used during the campaign not to release his tax returns all those years. Let's remember that the request by the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Richard Neal, it's about 6 years, turning over 6 years of returns, personal and business tax returns, which is apparently a standard procedure that the IRS advises that you keep at least 6 years of your tax records right. for your own good. So this is basically following a certain standard procedure.
Here is House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Richard Neal making this formal request. This will likely launch a court battle that could stretch months, even years. Here he is.
It's also a case that is likely to make its way through courts over a period of time. So we have to make sure that we handle it prudently.
Jack Beatty, Republicans say, you know, this is all unnecessary. Democrats say this is their duty, their overriding duty, their role, right, as overseers. How do you view this? Jack Beatty? Fernando, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
How do you see this?
Well, I think obviously we know that the president has fought this for a long time. He's fought against precedent of many candidates and other presidents releasing the tax form. So obviously he's going to fight this up. You know, obviously he never wanted this to go out in the public. He fought against it the whole campaign, and obviously now he's going to use the powers of the executive branch in order to avoid releasing these tax returns.
And Kimberly Atkins, you know, Republicans are saying this is just another investigative assault on Donald Trump.
Yeah, and it's tougher on this case because there is law. Congressman Neal is relying on the federal code, which gives the Congress the power to request exactly what they're requesting from the Treasury Department. And so this is going to be a fight. It'll likely go all the way to the Supreme Court and have the political ramifications along the way.
We are talking about the week's top stories with Kimberly Atkins, Fernando Pizarro, and Jack Beatty. And listeners, we'd love to have you join us. What do you make of the president's 180 on health care this week, on closing the border? Did Joe Biden get too close? I'm Jane Clayson. More after this break, including your calls. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the week's news this hour, and you can join the conversation. What do the early fundraising totals tell you about the Democratic 2020 hopefuls? President Trump is at his wall today. What do you want to do? What do you want him to do at the border? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. A great panel today. I'm speaking with WBUR's senior Washington correspondent, Kimberly Atkins, Univision Washington correspondent, Fernando Pizarro, and On Point News analyst, Jack Beatty. Let's turn to immigration now. It's been a week of back and forth for President Trump. The president repeatedly threatening to close the border with Mexico if the Mexican government would not restrict the flow of asylum seekers trying to cross into the U.S. Kimberly Atkins, what did you see in the president's sort of reversal this week?
Yeah, look, there is the Republicans are united around this idea that the border needs to be strengthened. I think Democrats even want a tougher, a strong border. But it's the way to get there, which is proving the problem. And I think Republicans realize once the president started talking out of frustration about closing the border entirely, that's a difficult proposition. That would cost a lot of American companies, farmers and others, millions of dollars. People cross over that border on a regular basis every single day. And shutting that down would cause a lot of problems, and it probably wouldn't solve the problem that they're trying to fix, which is this influx of people migrating up from El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and other countries because of the situation there. And so the president realized that, and it seems that someone pulled him back a bit, and now he's saying he's giving Mexico a year to try to curb the crossings from their vantage point before he acts.
On Tuesday, after President Trump had started talking about shutting down the border with Mexico, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he does not want to see the border closed.
We certainly have a crisis at the border. I think the president's right about that. Closing down the border would have potentially catastrophic economic impact on our country, and I would hope we would not be doing that.
There's the Senate Majority Leader, Fernando, talking about potentially catastrophic economic implications here. I mean, what is it, $1.7 billion of goods and services crossing over the border, cars, jeans, flat-screen TVs, you name it. Talk about the trade-offs here for the president, for the American people on this kind of decision.
Well, absolutely. According to Mexican figures, there's a 3 million Mexican border jobs at stake. I mean, we're looking at it only from the Americans' perspective. But yes, of course, all the trade, $1 point something billion, as you said, daily of goods coming through the ports of entry, and that would be a massive hit. Adding to Senator McConnell's Ted Cruz, who is not exactly a critic of President Trump lately, he obviously said that it was not the right thing to do to close the border. But the president, if I may, added to the confusion this Thursday. He says in first that he's going to add this year, then in a later appearance in the Oval Office with a Chinese delegation to talking about trade, then he's asked by a colleague, says, "Mr. President, does this mean you're going to keep the border open for a year?" And then he says, well, I didn't say that. So it's very confusing still what he means. Obviously, it looks like he's giving Mexico a year to deal with the drug issue, which for him is also very important. That's not just the issue of migration. Mm-hmm. The Mexican embassy yesterday held a press conference, and the ambassador and the undersecretary for North America were both present, and they also react to the assertion that President Trump has made in the last few days, including Friday morning, in which he says in the last week, Mexico has done more than has done for a long time in decades. And they said that that is his own interpretation. Mexico has deported more than 400,000 Salvadorians, Guatemalans and Hondurans in the last 3 years. That is 100,000 more than the U.S. has actually deported. So they're not happy about this idea. They say they're willing to cooperate with the president. Now, in another set of news, if I may add this, again, this morning, Friday morning, the president said the following, because apparently he is withdrawing the nomination of ICE Director Ronald Vitello, who
yes.
was a CBP career officer. And I actually had been promoted by President Trump to be the director of ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is another agency under DHS. And apparently now he's withdrawing that nomination.
Saying he wants to go in a different,
tougher direction.
Right.
Exactly. So that is a big, big story going on. And maybe he's not happy how things are being done in the Interior Enforcement, which is what ICE does.
Jack Beatty, did Republican lawmakers talk the president down on the border issue?
Yes, the president went out on a limb and they talked him back. He went out on another limb and he's busy at week's end sawing it off. That would be cutting off aid. Declaration would cut off aid to the Central American countries from which these wretched poor people are coming, and from where and all experts agree that cutting off aid to which mostly goes through. Is filtered through civil society programs that help people stay in these countries, that cutting off aid will hasten and increase the volume of mass migration, make people even more desperate because there'll be less support for them, and create even more crises. Of course, from a policy point of view, that looks like a recipe for failure. From a political point of view, the president wanting to charge up his base, you know, he told CPAC recently, I will protect you. That's his message for the campaign. And he can say to his supporters, I'm protecting you from these waves of brown immigrants who are now surging up and will be if this goes, if aid is cut off to the border.
So, Kimberly Atkins, by the way, cutting off aid to countries like Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador, Democrats say those cuts are outside the law and would need congressional approval.
Right. Democrats are definitely going to fight them, on at every point on that. But to Jack's point about what the president is doing, a lot of the reason for the increase in these migrants that you see coming to the border has to do with the president's policies. One was the fact that he had ordered there was this policy that separated children that had to be pulled back, that had to be abandoned, and children ordered to be reinstated. There are people who are – more people are coming now for fear that that program will return. His threats to close the border are actually causing more people to come. People, you know, they're being encouraged. They're being encouraged by smugglers and others who said, hey, you have to go now. Pretty soon you won't be able to because Donald Trump is going to change the policy. So his rhetoric is actually adding to the surge of migrants coming toward the United States, not keeping them away.
So that's immigration. The president also backed off of his threat this week to kill Obamacare, saying that he wants to deal with that after the 2020 election. Fernando Pizarro, why the reversal on Obamacare, on health care?
Well, this was one of those other occasions in which he says something and then he says, I didn't mean that. He did say that he did implied that he wanted to push, and he surprised congressional Republicans right after the same week of the Mueller report, or that when the Attorney General Barr sent his summary to Congress in what seemed to be a victory, he got into this other fight, which was to try to repeal Obamacare, in the next couple of years before the election. And I guess that panicked Republicans. Senator McConnell has insisted that he did talk to the president about this, and apparently the president then said, well, I didn't mean to do it before 2020, so we don't have the House. And he said on camera that it had been his decision to delay it. And so basically now this has been pushed back to after the election.
So Jack Beatty, Mitch McConnell made it clear he did not have the support in the Senate for this, certainly not in the House. What did you see in the president's announcement on health care?
Yes, the Republicans can't come forward with a replacement health care plan because of reasons of ideology to guarantee pre-existing conditions. There are two things you've got to do, and both of them require either direct government involvement, Medicare, or extreme regulation of the market, Obamacare. And both anathema to Republicans. They can't speak to pre-existing conditions within the limits of their ideology. The Republican Senate showed that. And when they were debating this in the summer of 2017, Trump's approval rating went down to 37%. Now, if health care is salient again in 2020, and it looks like the president may make it that with this announcement, that's not good news for him at the ballot box.
Kimberly Atkins, I mean, I guess the bottom line is Republicans don't have a replacement plan for health care.
They don't. There is no plan. There's certainly not going to be one coming out of Congress. Several Republicans, including Senator Susan Collins, who expressed her displeasure at this newfound focus on eliminating Obamacare, said that any new plan would have to come from the White House, that it is up to – if the president wants a new plan, essentially – he's going to have to come up with it and find a way to sell it. This is not a fight that Republicans want to have, certainly not right now, certainly not after the 2018 election, which health care was the top issue and one reason that a lot of voters said they went and voted for Democrats.
Well, let's turn to a meeting that the president had this week with the NATO Secretary General, wherein he criticized Germany for its defense spending. He also falsely claimed that his father was born in Germany. Fernando Pizarro, this got a lot of play this week. Talk about this NATO meeting with the Secretary General, with the president.
Well, as we all know, the president has not had a good relationship with NATO. He's been complaining for a long time since his campaign, and then he did it in one of his first trips abroad that most of NATO members do not contribute the same amount that the United States does, and that they should pay up. Basically, this time he criticized Germany, as you said, for not paying enough. It's not the first time he's done this. And at the same time, he also again claimed falsely that his dad was born in Germany. He's done this before, and he just does it publicly.
When he was born in the Bronx.
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, it turns out that his grandfather was German, and he came to the U.S. in 1885, and apparently, actually, he went back to Germany, and he may have come, with his wife, who was pregnant with Fred Trump in 1905. And apparently, according to the Washington Post, he was expelled from Germany in 1905 because he had actually emigrated illegally to the United States. So, but I don't know why the president keeps on claiming that his father was from Germany. I think it's good enough to say that your grandfather was. But anyway, the president keeps on making this claim.
Let me play this clip. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg addressing Congress on Wednesday. He praised the United States for the essential role it's played in NATO over the last seven decades, even as President Trump complained that NATO member countries do not pay their fair share.
America has been the backbone of our alliance. It has been fundamental to European security and for our freedom. We would not have the peaceful and prosperous Europe we see today without the sacrifice and the commitment of the United States. For your enduring support, I thank you today.
Kimberly Atkins, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, this puts Republicans in a tough spot. I mean, we saw the standing ovations that were given during that address for these ideals, this idea that America and its European allies need to stand strong together. This is what got them through tough times in history, including World War II. And this is a strong fundamental value that we share. It's very counter to the Trump doctrine. From the moment he stepped into the White House, Donald Trump has been America first, and it's caused European leaders to come and say publicly, we can't depend on the United States anymore. And that's something that troubles a lot of Republicans. It certainly troubles Democrats, but the president is not pulling away from it at all.
Before we go to break here, let me get in this story about Democrats running for president releasing their early fundraising numbers this week. Bernie Sanders at the top of the list, top of the leaderboard, $18 million. Kamala Harris, $12 million. Beto O'Rourke, $9 million. And Mayor Pete Buttigieg, $7 million. Kimberly Atkins, what did you read into these numbers?
I think overall it's good news for Democrats. It's very early in the campaign.
Is
you
it?
Have a lot
I mean,
of
Hillary
people.
Clinton had $46 million right. at this point.
But Hillary Clinton was also seemingly the heir apparent, the presumptive nominee from the very beginning. Right now, it is a wide open field. And you would think that a lot of folks would be holding back, waiting, seeing how this plays out before they start putting their money behind these candidates. What we're seeing is a lot of energy, a lot of excitement, Democrats are really focused on trying to unseat Donald Trump, and they're hearing a lot of good ideas from a lot of good people. I'm sure many folks are given to more than one candidate, and you're having people come out and do really well.
Jack Beatty, what do you see in these numbers?
Well, Bernie Sanders, I mean, in 2016, he said the average donation was $27. This year, it's $20. 88% of the donations under $200, majority from people younger than 39, and a total of almost 900,000 contributions. He's reached that in 41 days. It took 146 days to reach that in 2016. This is an extraordinary record for him.
Kimberly, you interviewed Mayor Pete.
Yes.
Mayor Pete Buttigieg this week in Boston, a relative no-name coming in with $7 million in presidential campaign fundraising. Not too bad.
Not too bad. I mean, I think, look, Democrats have an apparatus where they're able to raise these small amount donations very quickly, very easily. And we're seeing that is being – that's a big benefit to them. But you have – in Pete Buttigieg, you have somebody who is from the Midwest. He is a gay man. He is a veteran. He is somebody who can speak in about ideas and principles in a way that isn't combative. And I think after 2+ years of Donald Trump in office and the combativeness in Washington, I think a lot of people are drawn to that. And I think that's one reason he's resonating so much. But on the other hand, we have a big wide open field. We have a very diverse Democratic base. It's very different from the Republican base. And that's why you're seeing other people also doing really well. Senator Kamala Harris with her $12 million poll, she's been working very hard and doing it in a non-traditional way. She's been focusing on Black communities. Even when she goes to places like New Hampshire and Iowa, she makes a point in really engaging with everybody, all the communities in those states, in effort to build a strong base of support. So it's early yet, but I think that so far it's pretty good news for everyone. It may be tough news for Joe Biden because he's going to have to find a lane now once he jumps into this.
We'll talk about Joe Biden after the break. Fernando, our last 15 seconds here, your thoughts.
I think too many candidates so far. I don't know how those primary debates are going to be. Maybe
how do you
we're
find
have
a stage
three
big
shows.
Enough? Yeah.
3 hours of debate.
We're discussing the top stories this week with a great panel, Kimberly Atkins, Fernando Pizarro, and Jack Beatty. Listeners, we'd love to have you in on the conversation. What's your takeaway from the White House whistleblower this week? From the mayoral election in Chicago, the breach at Mar-a-Lago. More of your calls and more news after this break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. Listeners, we are talking about the week in the news, and you can join us. What's moving your world this week? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. My guest today, WBUR senior Washington correspondent Kimberly Atkins, Univision Washington correspondent Fernando Pizarro, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. This week, a former Nevada State Assemblywoman came forward with allegations of unwanted touching by former Vice President Joe Biden at a campaign event in 2014. Lucy Flores described her allegations in an article for New York Magazine in which she says Biden took her shoulders from behind, smelled her hair, and kissed the back of her head. Flores spoke with NPR.
You know, I just all of a sudden feel his hands and I feel him get up really close to me. And I'm just, you know, at that point processing and I'm thinking, okay, this is really weird. But then he leans in and then he like inhales and then he proceeds to plant this long kiss on the top of my head. And the entire time I'm just kind of like, what is happening?
So several women have come forward to say that Joe Biden's behavior has been inappropriate or unwelcome, Kimberly Atkins. I mean, Joe Biden made a video this week promising to be, quote, more respectful of people's personal space. What do you make of all this? It seems Biden was struggling a little bit to understand the concerns of these women.
Yeah, and I think that's the issue here, right? The initial statement that he put out said that he didn't intend anything inappropriate. And I think he has probably been told now, and we've heard folks like Nancy Pelosi say, well, it's not about your intention. It's about how you made someone else feel. And particularly in professional
in professional settings, I'm not sure there's ever a great time to plant a kiss on someone that you're not in some sort of relationship with. And I think he's understanding that. It's about personal boundaries. This isn't Me Too in the traditional sense that we've been talking about it. This is about the fact that people have the right to the autonomy of their personal space, and that is being violated in some situations, particularly when it comes to women. There's already a difference there in how women are treated in these public spaces and how men are treated, and all that's being brought to light. I think you were trying to see him try to say, okay, I understand that now. I will modify my behavior. He can still be a tactile politician and shake hands and put his arm around people to let him know that they understand him. But, you know, I think kissing is probably something he should stop.
A lot of callers want to get in on this point. Denise first in Attleboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Denise. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am really disappointed and unhappy about this situation. Joe Biden's a fabulous politician and a great man, and he may have overstepped the bounds of personal space. But, you know, I'm afraid that this is playing out as more than just that. And, you know, just before he's expected to enter the race, and you compare him to Trump, and there's just nothing. The other thing that upsets me about this is I'm a professional who's near the end of my career. I've worked my entire life to be in rooms with men, to be seen mm-hmm. as equal. And I've had more than my share of uncomfortable situations. But it's getting to the point now where I know men that say that they're not going to have lunch with women anymore, that they're afraid to be in the same room because they feel like everything's been blown so far out of proportion that we don't have balance anymore. And I wonder, I really wonder how we're going to get that back.
Denise, thank you. Jack Beeny, would you speak to that?
Well, we've heard that on our program. Callers have raised that fear, that sense that the culture is changing too radically. But surely there was a correction due. I mean, patriarchy is millennia old, and Joe Biden has behaved like an old-time patriarch. That is, he's as Kimberly said, he's undercut women, professional women, in moments of, you know, professional enactment. He's undercut their dignity. He's lowered them through these gestures. And now he said, I meant to support them, but they were undermining. And, you know, the gestures fit into a pattern. They're sort of the physical correlates, and worse than that, really, of his gaffes, of his verbal incontinence, of which the worst most recently was his claim that his boast, I'd take Donald Trump behind the high school gym and we'd have a fight. Mm-hmm. This was about, ironically enough, Trump's treatment of women. So Joe Biden has been a terrible candidate in the past because of these verbal gaffes, and now we see that there's a whole physical side of Joe Biden's, misbehavior.
It's not to downplay the allegation, but, you know, Kimberly Atkins, I'll point to Stephanie Carter, the wife of former Defense Secretary Ash Carter, coming to Biden's defense.
Yeah.
I guess some people see it different ways.
And a photograph of her was meant to sort of embody this idea that Joe Biden is too handsy, and she wanted to make clear that she felt supported in that moment and not violated. But look, I think when you have there's a difference between, to the caller's concern, there's a difference between engaging women as equals and being more likely to invade their space. I think most men probably don't nuzzle or kiss other men in a room. It's incumbent upon men to know the difference between that. The answer isn't avoiding women. The answer is learning how to treat them equally and with respect without violating their personal space.
Let's go to Juniper in St. Petersburg, Florida. Hi, Juniper. How do you see this issue, the Joe Biden issue?
Hi. I completely agree. It's with what Kimberly was saying. I wouldn't think that men would kiss other men in another room and invade their space. I think that, I don't think people's careers per se should be ruined, but I think that these types of behaviors need to be known, and I don't think that they need to be tolerated, because toleration is what got us here in the first place, and I think change is you know, and at least acknowledging the problems that and that are arising is the way to go about it. Like, I don't, I'm 20 years old. I don't want to live in a world where I'm not seen equally and I'm not treated as that. And I don't think that we need to just sit down and be quiet and not say anything, because that was how it was before, and that's not the world I want to live in.
Juniper, thank you. Let's get one more call in here. Edith in Canton, Connecticut. Hi, Edith. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I think Flores came out at a very critical time, just when Joe Biden is about to announce or not announce his running for presidency. I am all against any touching or harassment or anything that demeans a woman, but it's Joe Biden's nature, it seems, to do what he did for years. And I also look at those women today who stand by him, who might have been hugged or touched on the shoulder, and feel it was just his way of encouraging them at the moment.
Edith, thank you. I'm going to jump in, and I'm going to ask Fernando Pizarro to Edith's point, to all of our callers' point. Fernando, how do you see this, and might this all impact Joe Biden's decision to enter the race, which most people think he clearly will?
Well, I think some of these comments illustrate that that Biden has a political problem here. I think this is somewhat problematic for him. This is not exactly the way he would like the preamble of his official or formal launch of a campaign. I think, obviously, the fact that he has had to, first of all, his through statements, maybe his future campaign did not handle this very well, ended up having this video. And let's not forget that the President Trump, who bragged about touching women during the campaign, has actually used this politically as well, making fun of Joe Biden in posting a video of Biden speaking and apologizing in some way while touching himself. And anyway, I do think that this is not exactly the best news that Joe Biden wanted right before he's about to launch a formal campaign. Will he be able to overcome this in the future, and his enormous popularity will make up for this? We'll see. But I think, obviously, this was not the ideal environment.
Edith, callers, thank you very much. Let me move on here to the White House whistleblower this week, the security specialist, Trissa Newbold, who told Congress that at least 25 officials were granted security clearances despite, quote, disqualifying issues, including concerns about foreign influence, conflict of interest, drug use, criminal conduct. Apparently, this woman tried for a year to raise these issues. Kimberly Atkins, what did you make of this story this week?
Yeah, it sort of brings to light this issue about security clearances again, and the reason that we have them, and what could happen when those standards aren't met. Of course, the President of the United States has every right to grant a security clearance to whomever he pleases. That's the law.
Yes.
But doing so doesn't necessarily make it a good idea. The reason that we have these requirements is to prevent foreign entities or others to use someone's information about someone's drug use or their mental health or their financial status in order to exert pressure on them, exert them to do something that is not in the national interest. And when you're in Washington and lots of people hold different levels of security clearances, it also encourages them to continue to live their life in a way that doesn't put those clearances in jeopardy. They don't take bad financial decisions, and they seek help or care if they do have drug or mental health issues. They're not necessarily disqualifying, but it's to keep people on the up and up, and it's to keep them free of potential influence when you have folks like Jared Kushner, according to the reports, who did not meet these qualifications and were given clearances anyway. That's a problem, and this whistleblower was bringing that to light.
Fernando Pizarro, Trissa Newbold, this whistleblower, has a form of dwarfism, and in her testimony she said that her supervisors, in an act of retaliation, would move files to a shelf beyond her reach after she complained about these decisions to grant these security clearances over the objections of senior staffers. What did you make of this story this week?
Yeah, she said that she felt humiliated in this testimony that she had, as Kimberly was saying, to the House Oversight and Reform Committee. You know, she had told her bosses that clearances were quote, adjudicated, were not adjudicated in the best interest of national security. And then obviously she faced retaliation for this. And obviously she's not very tall because of this. Of this form of dwarfism that she suffers, and obviously she the fact that they moved the files way above her reach was something that really humiliated in front of her colleagues.
Well, from security clearances to security at Mar-a-Lago, the president's Florida resort. On Saturday, a woman was arrested there. She had two Chinese passports, four cell phones, and a thumb drive with computer malware. Yesterday, in a response to the arrest, President Trump was asked if he was concerned about the Chinese conducting espionage against the United States by spying on him at Mar-a-Lago. Here's what he said.
No, I'm not concerned at all. We have very good control. We have extremely good, and it's getting better. And cyber, frankly, what we're doing with cyber is a story in itself. No, I think that was just a fluke situation.
Kimberly Atkins, a fluke?
No. We have seen this president do things like use an unsecure cell phone despite being told not to. We've seen him conduct business in the dining room at Mar-a-Lago that could be overheard by just about anyone. It seems this president does not really fully understand why past presidents have been initially told not to use a cell phone. President Obama had to have a particular one built with all of this security inside for him to be able to use that, or for his kids to be able to use iPads. This is serious business, and it seems that the president not being concerned about it is a problem.
Let me get a caller in quickly on this point. Lee from Fort Mill, South Carolina. Hi, Lee. Quickly, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. My concern is that President Trump is profiting personally from people going to Mar-a-Lago. You don't sell memberships to Camp David. If you're going to call it a presidential compound, then it needs to be secure. And he has purposely undercut the Secret Service at every point to make it publicly accessible and not accountable. He has no concern for national security and obviously not concerned that he might be monitored or taped.
Lee, thank you. Thank you very much. I want to get to the jobs numbers. They are out today, and they're good. The unemployment rate holding steady at 3.8%, just above a 49-year low. Employers created 196,000 jobs in March. That's more than expected. Jack Beatty, these numbers relieve any concern that the economy is cooling in any way.
Yes, and good news for the president. We'll have to see how that holds up. The forecasts are not encouraging. The forecasts from, prognosticators and even the Federal Reserve are for growth that's a good deal lower than the president wants for his reelection. But we'll just have to see.
Another couple of stories this week. The man accused of killing rapper Nipsey Hussle was charged with two counts of attempted murder. Just in, President Trump says he will not attend the White House Correspondents' Dinner, says it's too negative. Also, Lori Lightfoot was elected mayor of Chicago this week. She's the first black woman to lead Chicago. She's also the city's first openly gay mayor. Here she is telling supporters she overcame the odds.
When we started this journey 11 months ago, nobody gave us much of a chance. We were up against powerful interest, a powerful machine, and a powerful mayor. But I remembered something Martin Luther King said when I was very young. Faith, he said, is taking the first step when you can't see the staircase.
Big story in Chicago this week, Kimberly.
It is. I mean, it's a change. It's a new beginning. You know, Chicago is a city that faces a lot of serious issues that the mayor is going to have to tackle. But for a moment, they can declare a victory in breaking some barriers there.
Fernanda Pizarro, about 10 seconds left here. Good recap of the week that's passed. What are you looking forward? What do you see in the week ahead?
Ah, my God. We'll see what happens with this border issue. I think that's keeping us busy, certainly, to see what what the president will do, and will he change his mind again on so many other topics.
Fernando Pizarro of Univision, we appreciate your time today and your expertise. Thank you, Fernando.
Thank you.
Kimberly Atkins, WBUR Senior Washington Correspondent. So great to have you and in the studio.
That's good to be here with you,
Thanks for coming in. And Jack Beatty, always great to have you. Have a good weekend, Jack.
Thank you, Jane.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get our On Point podcast and our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. And have a great weekend. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.